Unplugged, the podcast. Let me just say hi to everybody and welcome all the listeners and viewers to the newest episode of the podcast She Unplugged. And today I have again, I'm just fortunate. I've met all these amazing women in sort of like my career, and now I can tap into their wisdom. And today I've got Laura with me, and we kind of thought about talking about three topics and then we see where things go. And the topics will be purposeful leadership, leading through times of crisis, and inclusive leadership. These are the sort of the topics we're going to be diving in today. And let me just say, hi, Laura, how are you doing today?
Good morning or good evening, wherever you are in the world. It's lovely to be with you, Anya, and thanks for inviting me here. I'm excited about our conversation.
Good. Very welcome. Let me just ask you at the beginning to introduce yourselves to the listeners and the viewers. Where do you come from? What's your main business at the moment?
Right now, I'm executive coaching and team facilitation. So primarily working with high-level leaders in corporations, primarily in the tech, science, machine learning world of Silicon Valley has been mostly where I've been operating the last several years. But over time, I've worked with clients from all over, every kind of domain, from energy to technology to banking and finance.
How did you get into coaching?
Well, let me start by saying I've never had a clear career goal or path. I'm constantly asking myself, why am I here? What is the best and highest use of my time and energy? And that has led me on very divergent paths. So coaching was similar. It was something I was thinking about. I had taken a couple classes, but I had a marketing consulting business at the time. And what I found is that while I was advising my clients on marketing, other things would come up, like, what do I do with this employee? Or how do I have this hard conversation? And I would say, well, why don't you do this, this, and this? And then I would come back the next week and say, how did that hard conversation go? And they say, oh, I didn't really have time for that. And I thought, wow, if I were a coach, I could hold them accountable to having that conversation and give them feedback around what they needed to do differently. And I had an opportunity to work for a leadership training program. I went and did a seminar with a company and ended up doing more and more seminars, and eventually they asked me to come in and work for them. So I kind of got in backwards. I did the work and then I got the training on the job, and then I got officially trained as a coach.
Does it work holding them accountable now?
Yes, because that is part of the contracting when I work with people. And I'm pretty good at giving clear, direct feedback. Not to say, oh, you're bad, you didn't do the thing you said you were going to do, but, oh, you didn't do the thing you said you were going to do, what can we learn from that? And what do you want to try differently? Because maybe you didn't want to do that, or maybe you're afraid of doing that, or maybe you don't know how. So it's a very different conversation than the marketing days.
Yes, well, this is what I found also with my clients, but also with my coach, because I also have a coach, and it's kind of like being held accountable. It's not so much like, critiquing me, but more trying to find out together why it didn't work or why I didn't do it, because obviously something stopped me from doing it.
Yes, and that's the coaching relationship that's ideal, right? Is that we're in it together, that we're on a journey together, that we're learning together. It's not that I have any kind of power over you or dominance over your direction, but that you're taking advantage of my support to get you where you want to go.
How would you define purposeful leadership?
Well, as I said, I've always been on this path of trying to figure out what is my purpose, what is my role, why am I here? And that started at a very young age. In college, I wanted to go into psychology. I did very well in psychology courses. And then I had to take statistics, and I did very poorly in statistics. So I switched into being a business major. But this question has always plagued me. I ended up going into banking on Wall Street, and then I ran a marketing firm, and then I got into leadership development. And it was all by really looking more for what is my purpose, as opposed to what job do I want, what role, what title, what salary. It was really this constant, and still is, by the way, this constant exploration of who am I, why am I here, what impact do I want to make? And I find that particularly during this time of COVID, more and more people are asking this question. More and more people are pausing to take a look at themselves and reflect and say, what is important to me now? What is meaningful to me now? And how do I lead others through this time in a purposeful way? I was just reading, someone mentioned this morning that they were evacuated from the fire there's fires in Colorado right now that are pretty severe. And they mentioned that they were evacuated. And I've heard this from many people I know who've been evacuated here in Northern California, that when they went to see what was essential to take with them, there was actually very little that they felt like they could do without and they couldn't easily replace. And I think that's really how we can look at our purpose in life as well, is, you know, what is it that we take with us from place to place? What is it essential that we want to bring forward? What are our gifts and talents? What are our abilities? And how do we harness more of that potential?
How would you help somebody on that path? I'm also thinking about everyday person working at a cashier somewhere, not really diving into those topics at great length because they are more in this sort of survival mode, especially now in this time of crisis. How would you guide somebody, help somebody to take a little step into that direction of starting to look at that question, to get familiar with that taste of wondering?
Yes, I mean, someone who's a cashier, their purpose could be bringing joy to every person they encounter that day. And even just smiling and asking someone how they are, that is leading in a way, right? That's not just making a transactional relationship. That's really having a communication with someone who might have needed it. I, on my end, have typically done that the other way around. If I see a cashier who's looking unhappy, or, you know, if I feel like I can brighten someone's day in the line at Starbucks, I'm happy to do that. So purpose is not a position, and nor is leadership, by the way, a position or a rank. It is, how am I showing up in my life? How am I engaging with life? Maybe my purpose is to be a mother and raise my children. Maybe my purpose is my art, and I'm doing this job to pay the bills, but what I love to do is go home and paint. So it doesn't have to be something we're paid for. I do find that pursuing purpose in your work is most gratifying, if that's possible. But again, there's many leaders I work with who are in fields that they didn't study for, they're not experts in, and their purpose is more about how they lead others, how they communicate, how they guide, how they inspire.
Let me come back to it. How do I find that purpose?
So I've actually trademarked a process called the Purpose Initiative. And this is after working with thousands of clients over time and seeing where they would go from literally crying in front of me to then having creative ideas and innovative ideas and really being excited about what they're doing. And it's this three-step process. One is what I call making the unconscious conscious. So trying to understand what gets in my way to begin with, because often we're waiting for permission. We're waiting for someone else to tell us what to do. We're waiting for some divine inspiration to fall down from the sky, when really we can have these everyday occurrences that we just need to start paying attention to. So on the one hand is making the unconscious conscious, and discovering, are there patterns, are there beliefs, are there stories that I'm telling myself that are obstacles to even figuring this out? And the second part is disruptive experiments. So this is doing things you wouldn't normally do or taking small risks towards the direction of your goals. So what I have people do is I have them track what brings you energy and what steals your energy. And the more they start to recognize throughout the day, oh, smiling at the person at the cashier gave me energy. Stocking the shelves was draining. Sitting in this meeting with my colleagues drained my energy. Having a career conversation with my employee gave me energy. And these clues start to guide us in the direction of where is my purpose? Where is it playing out on a daily basis already that I may not be aware? So when I look at purpose, I'm connecting that to what gives me energy, what puts me in a flow state. And then that third piece is, where is their flow? Where is their synchronicity? Where do ideas just kind of fall from the sky? Where am I connected to what I call the genius field, where I'm in flow with the universe? So by getting out of my own way, starting to move in the direction of what gives me energy, that kind of multiplies over time. And suddenly someone will look back 6 months later and say, wow, I'm doing more of what I love, even in the same job that they have.
How can I, if I can't change the job, if I can't change the environment, how can I still live out my purpose?
Right. So when people do this energy experiment of tracking what gives me energy, what drains my energy, they might find that swimming gives them energy or art projects give them energy. And what I'm doing is giving them permission to pursue those projects, even if it doesn't look like there's some financial reward or that there's some sort of job payoff. And again, what I notice is the more people allow themselves to practice and apply what gives them energy, the more things seem to start unlocking in their workplace. And so it's looking at you as a whole human being. And also that puts work in a different perspective. Sometimes if I'm working on some sort of art project and that gives me a ton of energy, the way I show up at work might be different. And then opportunities might come in a different way. Or the work becomes less of a priority, less of a preoccupation. So I'm getting my work done so I can go home and write my book, for example. Or I'm getting my work done. So I had a CEO that I worked with and he was very unhappy and he wanted to quit being a CEO and go off and, you know, get a surf shack in the Bahamas. And his wife was about to have their second or third child. And she said, no, that's not happening. And he realized what his passion was around being a chef. So I said, well, there's a cooking school right near you. You can try that out on the weekends. You don't have to quit your job. So he started doing cooking school nights and weekends. And in that process, he realized he loved cooking, but he didn't really want to be a chef because he would be away from his family and nights and weekends. But in the process of becoming a chef, a new CEO opportunity came along. And now he has the dream job. And what he does every night is he thinks about, what can I cook for my family? How can I feed my family? So he found joy in being a chef, but he didn't need to abandon his whole career. And in pursuing what he loved, another opportunity opened up. And I find this time and time again.
By doing what I love to do, attracting more of the same, kind of like becoming happier, mm-hmm. is obviously I'm more fulfilled. Just, you know, if he went cooking and that fulfilled him, that gave him mm-hmm. joy and happiness, he showed up differently and a different mindset with a different energy at work. And maybe he was open to other possibilities. You said a new job as a new CEO in a different area came along. Maybe he wouldn't have seen that or wouldn't have given that a second thought if he hadn't done the cooking class before.
And it's about this might sound funny, but I almost see it like, what signal am I sending out? Mm-hmm. So like if I'm playing an out of tune cello on the street and waiting for someone to put money in my basket, but my cello is out of tune, people are going to walk around me. Whereas I could be in my apartment all alone playing a beautifully tuned cello because it brings me joy, gives me enjoyment, that sound is going to go out the windows and people are going to start saying, oh, who's playing that music? Where's that music coming from? They're going to be drawn to me. So it's something about this inner tuning that we're doing that happens when we start to do what, when we start to pursue what gives us joy or meaning or purpose and allowing ourselves to do that. We've been so conditioned. That's the making the unconscious conscious. That's the first part, is also the conditioning. Oh, you can't make a living as a writer. Oh, you can't be an artist. So you either have to turn your art into something that makes a living, like on the computer, or you abandon it altogether. And sometimes just allowing ourselves to do art quietly by ourselves in our room, it somehow shifts our energy that brings and spreads that out around us. It also gives permission to the people closest to us to pursue what they love as well. Our children start to watch us. Our spouses watch us. Our friends watch us. And they say, well, she's doing that. I want to do that too.
One thing is pursuing what brings you joy, what makes you happy. That cello player that plays in the lounge may be secretly hoping somebody's listening. Or is it really, no, I'm just doing it for myself and I'm not putting any expectations on the outcome, leaving the outcome open and just doing the thing that I love doing. How mm-hmm. do I do that?
Well, I think it depends on your purpose. You know, if your purpose is like, I took singing lessons a while back. And I realized I just wanted to sound better to myself. I don't want to get on a stage and sing. I don't want to do that for money. But recently I was in a speaking training and I was anxious. And I said, can I just sing something first just to kind of shift the energy? And I sang Amazing Grace and everyone was just like, that was so beautiful. And then I put it on Facebook because everyone thought it was really beautiful. I didn't do it for my own fame or fortune. I did it because people seemed to be touched by that. And I wasn't going to I'm not going to turn that into a career. But if I'm leading a workshop and I feel like I should sing a song to get everyone else to sing a song with me that everyone in the room knows most for the most part, or I can hand out the words, if that is going to help everyone's development, then I'm willing to do that. I think some artists are here to do art for themselves, and some people are here to share that with others. Some leaders are more introverted. Some leaders are more quiet about their work. It doesn't mean they're less impactful. And some leaders are on the front page of the news every day. So it's really you, for example, you decided that you had things you want to share, that you've met people that you want to share with other people, that there's some sort of message you want to deliver. And so you took the conversation from being a private conversation to be a public conversation. For whatever reasons that is, that your purpose is to bring our voices to the world.
Somebody just recently told me I should have a radio station. I said, I don't think so.
But see, but don't limit what the universe is asking of you, right? Because if that's an invitation, and that's what I always tell people, what's calling you? What's tugging you? Who's inviting you? Everything I've done, I used to think that I was like manifesting my own reality. And I realize every single opportunity that I have had has been an invitation from someone else. You and I met years ago, many years ago, at a conference in Europe that someone else invited me to that I had never heard of. And here you remember me all those many years later to invite me to have this conversation. So if you start paying attention to the invitations, who's inviting me? What's inviting me? What's tugging at me? What's unfulfilled inside me? That also is a great guide forward to go through this pathway. Mm-hmm. And every invitation I've had, similar to what you're saying, like, oh, no, I've learned when I'm most adamantly saying, oh, no, I'm not going to do that. It's like, watch out. I'm probably going to end up doing that. I used to say, there's no way I'm driving to Silicon Valley from where I live. The traffic is horrendous. It's horrible. Well, for the last 4 years, I've driven down there every week, several times a week, not during COVID, of course. So who knows what the world is asking of you? Pay attention to those invitations.
If we kind of tap into that, what gives me joy, where's my calling? Or what are people telling me? I think that's another thing. What are people telling me I'm very good at? Or somebody suggested the other day, you know, remember what you loved doing as a kid. You know, what was it that, like you said, you know, when time flies and you're in that cloud, in that flow state, what was it you liked doing as a kid? And how much, and it was actually one of the last podcasts, and how much of that are you having in your current life? How much, you know, what sort of percentage? And then see if you can shift it. For me, the next step would be to say, okay, if I've got an inkling where I might be going, but I'm fearful of failing, and I think a lot of people are, the what ifs, how can they deal with that?
Yes, and that's what I, when I say disruptive experiments, that's what I mean, is doing something out of your comfort zone that's not completely off the charts, but is risky and uncomfortable for you. One small tiny step in that direction.
Just give us an example.
Yeah. So for me, for example, I'm working on a tiny book. So I've been wanting to write a book for years. And instead of working on a novel, I've decided to work on a tiny book, which is going to be a few, you know, 50 pages versus 250 pages, just to start being an author in a small way. So I did an ebook, that's done. Now I'm going to do a tiny book that's actually a physical book, and then I'll move on to the next step. So that's the idea of a disruptive experiment, is picking something small that has some sort of larger payoff, but we're just stepping in that direction and saying, you know, I see you fear, and you're not going to get the best of me. And it's taking those actions, taking those steps, overcomes the fear to take the next step and the next action.
What was the moment when you decided, okay, I start with a tiny book or even with the ebook? Because there was something stopping you from writing the 250 pages. What changed? What shifted that you said, okay, well, maybe I start with the ebook or with the tiny book?
Yeah, I think partly it's this tug, like I'm saying, this inner pull of I want to do this. I mean, I started writing a book in the fifth grade in elementary school. I did really well in English class, and my teacher gave me permission to sit in the back of the room during English. My father was an English professor, and I was working on a novel, and it was like a mystery novel. So going back to what you were saying about childhood, I used to love to write in my journal. I used to love to write stories. I used to love to read stories and tell stories. But I also felt intimidated by it. So this idea, I had not, you know, the idea again was someone invited me in and said, I'm doing a tiny, tiny book class. Do you want to take the class? And we'll produce a tiny book in 30 days. So again, this was not my idea. It was an invitation from outside that I said, okay, that sounds doable. That sounds like I can do it. And I did the class and was not able to succeed the first time around. And I said, can I do this again? And they said, of course, as many times as you need to. So that's also about being willing to fail, being willing to be imperfect, getting support, having accountability. All of those are ingredients for me to take a hard, scary goal and try to make it more real.
How can we learn to see failure as something positive, as something we learn from, as something where we grow with?
Yeah, and you see that a lot in Silicon Valley. They talk about fail fast, fail hard. I recently heard that Reed Hastings from Netflix says, put sunshine on your failures. And as you said, this is not the way we were raised. We were raised to hide our failures and to be ashamed of our failures. I believe even the CEO of Peloton, which is insanely successful right now, I believe his first startup failed. And so that idea of what can I learn from this? And as a coach, you know, when someone fails or feels like they failed, you know, my first question is, that's great. What did you learn from that experience? How can we grow from that experience? And, you know, Brené Brown always says shame grows in the dark. And so if we put light on these areas and not even, how do we even not call it a failure? How do we decouple this word failure from our emotions and just say, well, that didn't work. What can I learn and what can I do differently going forward? And sometimes our greatest failures are thank goodness something failed, right? I tell people all the time, we want, you know, we love the signs that say, go in this direction, and the doors open. And then we hit the door that's closed and we just keep banging on it instead of saying, oh, I'm not supposed to go through this door. There must be another door. I just don't see it yet. So I think there's also taking the stigma out of failure would be helpful as well.
And how do we do that?
Yeah, I think just being willing to risk failing and not seeing it as a setback, but seeing it as actually part of the learning process. If you think of launching a technology, they want to find the problems in the system as early as possible. They want to find the failures as early as possible. They welcome the failure because that means they're learning and discovering faster about the technology so that it doesn't fail later on.
Somehow in our, I mean, I've got two daughters, 13 and 15 currently. And in school, if I look at sort of like how would they see failure, and it's not in a good light. Maybe when we are more mature and the way you described it in that business area, and also, I mean, that's why I love the Disney strategy, because it looks not at failing, but it looks at how can I make something possible, something unbelievably, unimaginably, how can I make it workable? And he goes through these different phases, but already with our children, we look at who's the winner and who's the loser. So wouldn't we have to start already making those shifts in our mind earlier?
Absolutely. You know, by the time you and I work with people, they've been so conditioned for decades, right? And that's what I talk about all the time when I talk about this. It's, well, you know, you had to be the first and the best in school, and you had to get the first and best grades, and then you had to go to the best university, and then you get into the best company, and then we put you in a team and we say, play nicely, share, work together. Whereas I've been competing alongside these people my whole life. So I do think that changing early on and having a father like the founder of Spanx who, you know, if we as parents are continuing that conditioning of, did you get the A grade? And I mean, I see that with my niece. She's 16 and she's 18 now. And I'm still asking her, you know, how are you doing in school? And she says, I got an A. And I'm like, that's great. And I'm in graduate school right now. And I'm all about, I love it when I get the A. But I've also can look at that from a place of, that means I worked hard. I studied hard. I engaged myself. I didn't just coast. So I do think that there is an aspect of our education system that's not healthy, that perpetuates this competition. But I also, when I look at my niece who, when she was around 16, she was not enjoying her work at all. She was feeling very stressed about school. We were able to find a way for her to get an education that gave her more control and independence over her own learning. And it was incredible night and day how her whole trajectory changed. She loved school. She couldn't wait to do her homework. I mean, this was unheard of before, because she took charge and she felt in control. And she was also thinking more in lines of, what is my purpose and how does this fit with my purpose of what I want to do in the world versus, oh, I just have to get an A to check the box. So I think early on helping people think, not just, you know, we ask people like, what do you want to be when you grow up? I didn't know what I wanted to be until my late 30s, you know, and that's partly why I'm so passionate about this topic. That was so painful when people would say, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I didn't know. When I was in college, executive coaching was not a career option. There are people who are yoga teachers. That was something people did in India. That was not a career option, you know. So we don't even know at a young age what our career might be. When if you had said to someone 10 years ago they could make a living with computer games, you know, that would have been unheard of, right? And now people are making a fortune on computer games. So we don't know at that age. And I know that in Europe it's even more stringent than the United States of, you know, your destiny is pretty much carved out fairly early on in your education process. And I think that makes it harder to do what we're talking about, which is like figure out who I am at a later stage in life. So it is working against those systems in some way to truly find ourselves.
And I would even say working within the system, but against the system. And that makes it, I think, very difficult. I mean, it's maybe really about allowing our children to say, well, where do you feel most alive? Where are you the happiest? Where do you enjoy yourself the most? And let's just see what career we can kind of like create around that.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Where does it match up? You know, where do my strengths and my abilities match up with possibilities to earn a living?
The founder of Spanx is one of those books, you know, it's filled with struggle, but at the end she succeeded. So I'm wondering if you could share a couple of stories of clients that you had in your coaching practice where they came to you and you helped them on that road to finding their purpose and maybe the change of career.
Yeah, I have someone now who is in the human resources field, and it's actually thanks to one of her children having some health issues that she started studying diet and nutrition to be able to support his health. And so then she decided to go study diet and nutrition for herself, and she's becoming certified as a health coach. So that's something that what I'm a big fan on is you don't have to jump off the track of your career and go do some totally new thing. You can start learning something new in parallel with your career and sort of try that on. Just like my example with the chef, the CEO chef, you know, he really wanted to quit his job and go become a chef. And I said, why don't you just try it on? My niece, for example, wanted to be a vet. And then one time she came to the vets with us with my cat and there was some blood and she realized, I don't want to be a vet. You know, so it's this idea of we can have a glamorous idea of something, but if we don't try it on a little bit, we may not see the reality of that. So that's one example where this woman is getting certified to be a nutritional coach, and then she'll see it where she wants to go with that. If she decides to transition to that as a career or maybe have a couple clients on the side to experiment with and then go back and forth and see what really works for her. So that's what I call the parallel path. You're on a train and you say, okay, I'm going to get this other train going down the rails. And at some point I'm going to switch tracks to that other. I'm laying down the rails to be able to switch tracks at some future time. So that, because I find that when they try to just leave something, they leave their sense of security, they leave their financial security, that causes more stress, that causes more tension. It makes it harder to actually transition. Whereas trying things out gives like a smoother changeover, when possible.
Well, it's a little bit like when you talked about, I had the image of going into a shoe shop and trying on some walking boots. Nobody would ever just buy walking boots and then go on a, I don't know, 20 kilometers hike first time. They try them on in the shop and then you're advised to try them at home and then, you know, go on short walks and then, you know, but it's a little bit like that, what you described. Yeah. What would you say are the most common problems or challenges the coaches are coming to you with?
Well, this is number one, you know, is who am I? What am I doing? What are my strengths? What are my gifts? By the way, volunteering is another way, you know, trying out another department or saying, hey, I have an extra few hours. I've seen people achieve amazing things. Now, that's more common in the technology world, but people who were not involved in big projects volunteered for a big project and got you know, written up in major publications about their work that was not their job. So that's always an option as well. Yes. What is my purpose? How do I find more joy and purpose in my work? Time management is huge. And that also ties into the system, because I feel like the more you do what you pursue that gives you energy, the more time you feel like you have, even though we only have the same amount of time, we start to have a different relationship with time. Time management is one. And then, you know, me getting to my next level and me helping others get to their next level. So not only just how do I get promoted, but how do I become more strategic? How do I become more of a thought leader, less of a task-oriented manager and more of an actual leader? That is a big subject that comes up a lot. How do I lead through others versus myself kind of powering through? How do I lead teams? How do I lead organizations? Which is very different than leading myself or smaller teams. When someone goes from leading 10 people to leading 150 people, they're no longer the expert in what they do. And that's very uncomfortable. Going back to what we were talking about in school and getting the A grade, now we have to trust others. We have to be vulnerable. We have to rely on others to get the work done. We can't expect ourselves to do it. And in fact, if we attempt to do it that way, we will fail. So those are some of the key things that I'm talking to people about every day.
And when you just described that shift from running a team or an organization, let's just connect that to and becoming comfortable with the idea of failing. Mm-hmm. Becoming comfortable with the idea of not every strategy working first time around, but you having to try different avenues. You're having to let people try out, fall down, and encourage them to get back up and try again. So it's a completely different ball game. I mean, you're still running only probably 10 people because you're not managing like everybody in the company. But that whole concept of failing, learning, the learning environment, learning companies, you know, I think that is a big shift when you go to that higher level of leadership.
Yes, and just because you're a leader doesn't mean you're going to create a learning culture. That is an active, constant work, right, for yourself and for others to make it safe to learn, to have that psychological safety in your team to be able to make mistakes, to not be called out for that publicly or to be called out and celebrated for it publicly so that people realize, oh, we don't hide our failures here. We actually learn from them and share with each other. So as a leader, having a commitment to creating a culture of learning and development, not just the talk, but the walk of that is really crucial.
And it doesn't happen overnight.
It doesn't happen overnight. It doesn't happen very often. It takes real conscious effort, you know?
Yes. Well, it's really taking a clear decision of wanting to create that kind of environment, mm-hmm. and setting an example.
Yes. And I think more and more people are interested in this and talking about it. I find, especially in corporate America, programs and classes and courses and education that I used to have to pay for myself to go study are being taught in companies. It's normal now to take a meditation class or a yoga class or a personal development class in your organization. So I've, at least in Silicon Valley, which I think is always the pioneer where corporations are heading, I feel like there's this commitment to personal as well as professional development, because people see the trade-offs, they see the payoffs of, if we provide well-being, then our people are going to be more effective employees. Especially now during COVID, that resiliency, you know, are people doing okay? Are we checking in with them? Are we providing resources for their well-being? Are we making sure that people are still doing self-care during a time of incredible chaos? And as you've probably seen in the news, again, in the arena that I work in tech, many companies are saying, you know, you can work remotely forever now, or we're closing our offices and we're not going back to offices, which creates a whole nother realm when you think about purpose, because, oh, maybe I can live somewhere else and have a different home for my family. Maybe I can go move to a place that has land and I can start gardening or grow my own food. The shifts that we are going to see from this year are going to have ripple effects for all of time in how we work, where we work, and how work gets done.
What skills do you think are required more of in this specific time in terms of leadership?
Well, I mean, if we think about women right now who are working and raising families and educating their children in the United States, many schools are not back in session, or they're back in session in a staggered fashion. And women are having to pick up a lot of that slack. There's studies that are showing how many women have left the workplace during this time. And I think that going back to this competition, the pressure, the stress, the performance orientation we put on ourselves, that doesn't help. If I feel like I've got to keep up with my colleagues, or if I admit that I'm struggling, that I'll be judged unfairly and get a bad rating this year or lose my job even, can we have safe conversations in the workplace about the stress that people are under? And can we make sure that we're not rating them lower because of external circumstances that are out of their control? I think that's really key for leadership right now, to be looking at what are we doing for people who are in situations that are not comfortable, that they don't have the resources that they need, that they don't have the support that they need. That I'm sure you've seen this too, coaching people where children are running around, or I coached someone who was tucked away in a walk-in closet. You know, it's like whatever we need to do. I've talked to people in their car, you know. So people are doing what they need to do to find work and to do their work, but it's a very stressful situation. So employers and leaders need to be aware of that and paying attention to that. And I think employees need to be willing to talk about it and not just cover up their stresses, but really put that out in the open so that it's a real conversation.
Yeah, and I think it's about taking the first step and being vulnerable, and at the same time feeling safe. You know, it's always about knowing who you can share certain stories with and who you shouldn't. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. Now, we talked about the challenges your clients come with to you. Can you share a couple of struggles that you've experienced in your life and how you overcome them?
Well, in terms of this, you know, who am I? What am I doing? I worked in the banking world. And again, I accidentally landed on Wall Street. I mean, it's just incredible when I look back at my career, how I ended up where I ended up. And I say accidentally, you know, if I were coaching myself, I would say that's ridiculous, because I probably sent out 1,000 resumes. But I ended up on Wall Street by doing a temp job and selling a home banking online service in the 1980s when no one had a computer at home. But I happened to have a bunch of IT guys working in my building, and they all bought what I was selling. So, you know, I feel like I do all this hard work to make something happen, and then it happens and it almost feels like it's out of the blue, but I have to remind myself, yes, but I did all this hard work over here. I didn't get the result over here. I thought I was going to get into an advertising job. I ended up in a banking job, but it was exactly what I needed. So those struggles that I go through, I was studying for the Series 7 to become a broker on Wall Street, and the market crashed in the 80s. So that job completely went out the window. But again, like, that door closed and I realized, oh, I'm not supposed to go through that door. I'm supposed to go through another door. And so I feel like when we can see transition as these, like, I work hard, I struggle, I work hard, I struggle, I feel lost, I feel confused, but I keep persisting at it. I keep trying to get clarity, and then something will show up and break through. I left that banking job, moved to California, because my sister said, you should live in California. Why do you live in Manhattan? And so I moved to California, and again, I started in a temp job at a bank, working for someone who was doing my job in New York. So here I was, like a secretary or an assistant, we call them a secretary in those days, being an assistant to someone who was in the job that I was in previously. So I, again, kind of started at the bottom. And, but that experience made me realize, I don't want to do this. This is not the field for me. I know I don't want to be a banker. And I ended up, someone said, hey, I know someone who's looking for help in public relations. I ended up going to this company, convincing them that I had the skills, and ended up working in public relations. And then shortly after that, about a year after that, someone offered me to do public relations for his company on the side. I did that on the side, and he said, you have to quit your job or you can't do this work. And again, I let go of everything. I let go of my paycheck. I trusted that the universe was on my side. And sure enough, I had like 5 clients after that and did very well. You know, so it's also been taking that leap and having that faith that if I do the thing that's tugging at me, as hard and scary as that feels, that something's going to work out, that it's tugging at me for a reason, that this person is telling me this for a reason, and to pay attention to that and listen to that. Because it's the places where I've stayed safe that I actually have more regrets than the places I've taken a courageous leap. Now, that's just me. I don't have children to feed. So I can take leaps. I can go to a cheaper place to live. I can start at the bottom again because I've got the ability to do that. And I'm willing to do what it takes to get there. So if I have to do a temp job to get to the next thing, I'll do a temp job. And that's part of letting go of, oh, the next rung has to be the higher, the higher, the higher. My career is more like this. But it, you know, I'm moving in a direction. It's just been a jagged direction.
When you talk about it, it sounds casually easy, kind of like it just happened to all work out. Did you feel the same being inside of that process? Did you, being inside of the transitions, did you feel that faith? Did you take consciously that leap of faith? Or did it just afterwards look like, oh yeah, okay, now I can see how things evolved?
Looking back, it sounds effortless. In the moment, it's torture. In the moment, I'm a very indecisive person. I have a hard time making decisions. I torture myself day and night with what should I do? What should I do? What should I do? And I have a lot of fear. I have a lot of anxiety. I wake up very early in the morning, like 3 or 4 in the morning, because my brain just won't stop. And sometimes I'll just get up and start working because it's like, why lay there and let my brain torture me? So that's why I meditate. That's why I do the work on myself of recognizing that there's fear and unhealthy thoughts, and work with what can I do to have more healthy thoughts? What can I do to take myself in the direction I want to go? And I can say that now because I've gone through this many times over and over, but there's always transitions, right? There's always endings and beginnings. And one of my mentors used to call this honorable closure, and to recognize, you know, I think we want things to last forever, but they don't. And then we want to cling to those things. And we cling to jobs that we shouldn't be in anymore. We cling to people we shouldn't be with anymore. We cling to places that we shouldn't live anymore because we want that security. And yet sometimes things come to an end and we need to know when it's time to let go. And that's really hard.
And that's exactly the second question that sort of popped in. So honorable closure, how do you distinguish between it's time to let go of something, of a dream, of a job, of a spouse, of a place, and persistency. You have to stick with it.
My second marriage has been 18 years now. And one of my conditions is that we don't have to be together forever. So one of my conditions is, if this isn't working, then we need to talk about it and see what our options are. And there have been many, many times that I thought, oh, it's done. We're done. And yet I thought, well, is there one more thing that I can do differently? Or is there one more conversation to have? And it's always led to a place of evolution and growth. And I think that's really the question for me personally, is I am more interested in my soul's evolution and growth than anything else, frankly. And that is why I've put myself in situations that may not have been the best financial situation, but I knew I was going to grow and learn. And that's sort of my trade-off, is am I still growing? Am I still learning in my relationship? Are we growing? Are we learning? Are we evolving together? Or are we somehow just hunkering down and trying to stay safe and not have change occur? So the same with the job. If I'm in, and I see this with people all the time, you know, they'll tell me, well, you know, my job's okay, blah, 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 blah. And then I'll say, you sound bored. And they'll say, oh my God, you're right. I'm bored out of my mind. And I'm like, but it's safe. They're like, yeah, it's safe. I got the paycheck. I got the title. I studied my whole life to be a lawyer. I'm the top partner in this firm, and I can't stand my job. And it's like, well, why are you torturing yourself like this? How do we help you either have the same title and the same role, but do different things in it, which is what gives you energy, what drains your energy, or how do you transfer those skills to something else? So an ending doesn't have to be, I'm quitting my job, I'll never be a lawyer again, I'm going to go on the street. It could be, how do I transfer this into something that does give me joy, that is interesting to me? So closings can all, you know, endings can be beginnings at the same time.
I think the central point for me was when you said, you know, am I still learning? Am I still growing? Mm-hmm. To know, as long as I keep learning, as long as there is something else to try that I haven't tried before, even if it's uncomfortable, but as long as there's something else I could try, I'm still on the track of pursuing that idea, that dream, that vision. And only when I come to the point of like, well, there's nothing else I can do, at least I can't think of anything, or I'm even bored, then that's the moment to turn the page. Right. So that's very helpful. That's really good. With all the changes in your career, and you said it went like that, but over the years, kind of like going up, what are the main lessons you would take out of that?
Don't let fear stop you. Like, you can have fear, but don't let it paralyze you from moving forward. Get friendly with your fear. Give yourself permission to try new things. Don't get stuck just doing what you know. Be willing to fail and try new things. And do what you love.
Was there a question you wished I had asked, Laura, that you could answer now? Or is there something where you say, that is most important to me, I really, really would like to stress it, and so I'm going to repeat it?
I feel like we both touched on this subject of, we didn't use the word, but perfectionism, and how perfectionism really kills all dreams. I was in 3 calls last week where the topic was around action over perfectionism. And I think that's the one thing I'm trying to work on in my life, is writing a tiny book full of flaws and imperfectly is better than creating a perfect book that never gets published.
Laura, thank you so, so much for coming on the podcast and sharing your lessons with us. I very much appreciate it. And for me, let me see, I think I take out also the perfectionist, because I am one of them. And at the same time, that distinction, is there still something else I can try to make it work? And if not, or if I'm bored, then I need to change something. Then I have to have that honorable closure. I like that. So thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
You heard a production by Anja Förster. Copyright Anja Förster. Music by Audionautix.com.